Brian Lehrer on WNYC. You can follow me on Twitter at Brian Lehrer. Like me on Facebook at Brian Lehrer WNYC. Last Thursday, we had Dr. Judith Rodin on the show to discuss the lessons learned here in the New York area from destruction wrought by Sandy. Dr. Rodin is president of the Rockefeller Foundation, where she spends a good deal of time overseeing initiatives to prepare small and middle-income countries to deal with the adverse effects of climate change. She's also the co-chair of the NYS 2100 Commission. That's one of three commissions formed by Governor Cuomo to recommend improvements and assess the region's preparedness for the next storm. This week, we're going to continue our conversation as we examine the way forward. We'll take a closer look at what rapidly expanding cities and emerging economies are doing to prepare for some inevitable amount of displacement brought about by climate change, and how these strategies can be utilized in more advanced economies with established cities like right here in New York. Dr. Rodin, thanks for joining us again. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me.
We spent some time on this last week, but just to refresh our listeners, the Rockefeller Foundation has spent more than $90 million in a drive to prepare the most vulnerable cities and small and middle-income Asian and African nations to prepare from the potential fallout from climate change. Give us a great example of that.
Well, I should say not only small countries. We're working in populous countries like India and Indonesia. So the idea was really just to look in Asia and Africa at where the vulnerability was the greatest. And that's why I think the generalizability to New York, which has so much of the same river structure in the upper part of the state and the kind of coastal ecology downstate that is reflected in many of these other countries. And so part of the work, for example, in Vietnam, which has such a long and vulnerable coastline, has been a lot of hydrology mapping along the coastline to demonstrate where and what buildings should be occurring, something that we think is critically important before any more building decisions, or we Rockefeller think is critically important before any more building decisions are made in New York. Or in Thailand, in Chiang Rai, we've been looking at how the intersections of rivers and streams need to be allowed to go back to their natural flow, because like upstate New York, many of those are right on the edge of floodplains. Obviously, they're flooding into the floodplains, and it's been the diversion of the natural running of those rivers and streams that has led to the increased vulnerability to flooding. So from those kinds of water management to solid waste management projects that we have in Indonesia, again, on coastal ecologies that are very, very similar to what downstate New York looks like, where you really need to build into your solid waste management a prediction about flooding, a prediction about temperature increases, a prediction about storm and rainfall variability, and you wind up with a very technologically different municipal solid waste management system.
Those are really interesting examples, and how they might be applicable to New York is really interesting. And further, you say that many of these initiatives are low cost and would place relatively little burden on government budgets or taxpayers.
Well, they are low cost. Many of these we have funded, so whether ultimately
they weren't low cost for the Rockefeller Foundation.
Correct. And they may not be low cost in the aggregate for municipal or state governments. But think about another one that we've done, this one in Da Nang in Vietnam, which is a storm and flood resistant credit and housing scheme where you start to provide credit to improve the homes of the poorest households that are in the disaster prone areas. But that you reconstruct them in a flood and storm mitigating way. you establish a revolving loan fund for small businesses so that they can get back on their feet more quickly and, again, rebuild in a more resilient way. But at the same time, you start working with insurance companies to develop insurance schemes that are incenting the right kind of rebuilding, something that we've got to import to New York as we think about our rebuilding at this time. So it's not only how you put state or local or federal money in, it's also very, very much how you create the right incentive structure for private companies to both allow projects and support projects in ways that will support resilience, support mitigation, at the same time providing opportunity for the consumer to gain from those interventions in a very systematic and proactive way.
Right. And I wonder, as you look toward making specific recommendations along these lines to the governor, whether you think that there's going to be less political resistance in Washington to helping to fund some of these adaptation measures than there is to global warming prevention. You know, there's such a resistance in Congress to even accepting on one side of the aisle that there is such a thing as man-made global warming or that it threatens the United States in any way. And yet when we talk about adaptation measures to be ready for the floods that are going to come because it's documented that the water levels are rising and things like that, I think there isn't as much resistance to adaptation. What's your sense of that?
There isn't, and you even saw that on the global level. The only place where the climate change negotiations that happen annually have gotten any traction is on the agreement of countries to put money into adaptation measures. I'm not sure why that has less political tonality than mitigation measures, because in a sense, a lot of the adaptation measures, fortunately, are also mitigation measures, but it doesn't rely on you, I guess, admitting that climate change has already occurred. You can just look at the evidence of five storms or whatever, and you don't have to label it as caused by climate change in order to believe that we have to do something about it. I think the politics in Washington are really going to be, and we're going to see this play out now, at the heart of how much money we get in terms of disaster recovery and how it's labeled. But think about a framework, Brian, that I think we need to think about, and that all of our work, both in the U.S., in New York already, and in the Gulf states, as well as overseas, shows us. This has to be a combination of federal resource strategies, state and local resource strategies, and private sector strategies. And we have an opportunity to really think about an integration of all of these mechanisms of funding in order to advance what we need. And I hope that we can frame it in the right politically saleable labels, but we've got to really understand that these are opportunities now for investments and for creating the right kind of structure that will allow these investments to continue in the future.
Right. And this may be out of your task list, you know, with what the governor has asked you to do. But I wonder if there's a case to be made by an environmental group or somebody that prevention is cheaper than adaptation, that rather than rebuilding all the roads and bridges and buildings and beaches and everything and just do that every time there's a storm in reaction, that more money to go into prevention, whether it's green energy or whatever, might actually be cost effective just from a dollars and cents point of view.
It is absolutely not outside of our purview. And the one thing I am confident about is that you will see that in the commission's report.
Uh-huh.
Obviously, we have environmentalists on the commission, but we're all realists, and you can only look at the numbers to understand that if all we're doing time and time again is adding money to respond to these bad things after they've happened, the cost will be doubled, tripled, quadrupled relative to what taking preventive measures now really can truly prevent.
And of course, in this country, we're so used to hearing about the costs and burdens that environmental legislation would place, whether adaptation or prevention, on companies and corporations. But we know that one thing the Rockefeller Foundation talks a lot about is presenting climate change preparation and adaptation as a business opportunity. And, of course, your group is in the New York Times today as trying to influence next year's mayoral race in a pro-business fashion. So can you talk about how, you know, talk about pro-business opportunities from adapting to climate change?
Well, we think that these are huge pro-business opportunities. And again, I say this with the absolute recognition and deference to the fact that people have and are still suffering from the effects of Sandy and other storms. But nonetheless, we can already see the business stimulating effect of rebuilding. We at Rockefeller believe that every infrastructure investment is a pro-business investment. It's a job creator, and the coalitions that we've helped to fund in Washington, which try to push for more infrastructure funding, more transportation funding that really recognized environmental issues, and frankly, issues of helping the poorest people gain access to places of employment, all need to be folded together. If you invest in infrastructure in a way that really prevents and mitigates, is responsive in an adaptation and resilience-building way to what you can't prevent and mitigate, and also thinks at the same time about job creation, we can both advance our economy and advance business opportunities while investing in areas that will protect our environment and the well-being of our people. So there's no reason to separate economic development from human development, from environmental protection and development, if we think about this smartly and holistically. And I assure you, this is front and center of what the commission is thinking about.
Yeah, and I was wondering, and I don't know if anybody can prove it, but when the jobs numbers came out for last month and there wasn't as much increased unemployment as people anticipated as a result of Sandy, I was thinking, well, Sandy destroyed jobs and Sandy created jobs.
Right, exactly. And that always happens. If we can do it in a non-storm recovery moment, we can create jobs and then we don't have to just have the net difference of those that were the destructive job component pieces. So we think it is absolutely critical that both Washington and the state, and again, the city too, this has been a crucial rallying cry that the Rockefeller Foundation has been promoting for the last 5 or 6 years, that if you focus on these resilience-building infrastructure efforts, it is an equity play, it is an environmental play, and it is a job creation play altogether. And it is a triple win that it stymies me that there isn't more respect for and recognition of that fact.
Well, we just have about 30 seconds, but I think we're at kind of an astonishingly open moment in our political system right now with the reelection of President Obama and the different coalitions that are forming. We see all of a sudden gun control is back on the table after the tragedy in Connecticut. We see all of a sudden global warming is back on the table after Sandy. And these things seem to be coming together to be launching conversations that weren't possible 6 months ago.
I agree with that. Not possible across the aisle and not possible even within parties. And so let's not squander this moment. It really is way too important.
Judith Rodin, president of the Rockefeller Foundation. We look forward to talking to you when your report actually comes out, recommending specific actions to Governor Cuomo. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.